Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, March the 10th, day number 69 of 2014. And tonight we're going to be talking about something called Diez de Marzo, which literally means the 10th of March in Spanish. It's a very important date, or I think it is, a very important date in pre-Castro Cuban history, a date in the early 50s that I think in many ways maybe foretold what was in store for Cuba in the 50s. And our good friend Victor Trey, the author of a couple of Cuban books, is going to be joining us tonight as we look back at this date. We're certainly not pretending to be experts on the 10th of March, but we want to look at that date because I do think it had an impact in the 1950s in not only setting up much of the movement against Batista, but really in many ways it may have ended up hurting Batista's legacy, and I'll get into that a little bit with my friend Victor. So tonight we're going to look at El 10 de Marzo, or the 10th of March, an important date in Cuban history. My book, Cubanos in Wisconsin, you can get yourself a copy of the book, print or Kindle, at the Amazon, or you can go to our website, Cubanos in Wisconsin, and get yourself a dedicated copy of the book. We've done quite a bit of that, and we appreciate all of you who've submitted your request that way. It's always a lot of fun. I think the best part of writing a book is dedicating the book. At least that's been my experience after, I've only written one book, but that's been my experience after writing this one book. We're going to take a break, and we've got our friend Victor on the other side. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Let me say hello to our good friend. Once we get the mic on, there you are. Let me say hello to our good friend, Victor Trey. How are you, Victor?
Oh, I'm doing great, Silvio. Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, it's a great honor. It's a great pleasure to have you on. I mentioned in the introduction that you are an author yourself, and I do have a question about being an author. I was saying that I've only written one. You've written several books, so for me, it was, I guess I'm still dealing with my freshman experience, but for me, one of the most fun part of having written a book, after all the sacrifice you go through, is dedicating it to somebody. I don't know if you had the same experience.
Sure. You know, I mean, the first time it happened to me, actually, the first thing I ever had published was an essay in an anthology, and there was a signing, of all places, in Brooklyn, New York, and I went and I read my short story, and people bought the book, not from me, but from the, you know, person who put the anthology together. And I remember the first time they came to me for me to sign it, I'm like, you want me to sign it? Really? But you know, it is one of the things in the writing process, though, that continues to stump me. I have a lot of difficulty writing something short. And so I have my standard in Spanish when I sign it in Spanish, but I don't have a signature dedication in English, you know, beyond, you know, warmest regards or something like that, because I could never think of what to say. So if you have any advice for me, I'll take it.
Well, I'll give you something that I finally settled on, because I think everybody has the same problem. You want to write something
right.
I finally settled on this. Thank you for reading my book.
Oh.
Regards, Silvio, or whatever. And I
brilliant.
I've stuck with that one. And now, once in a while, they'll tell you, I want you to dedicate, and that's what happens with our website. They'll say, I want you to dedicate this to Abuela, you know, Abuela Maria, right, or something.
Right.
So you dedicate it. When they specify something, obviously you follow. But when you're just doing Like when I went to Miami to Cuba Nostalgia, and I was just signing the book for not strangers, but people I didn't know personally, I would simply say thank you for reading my book, regards, Silvio. And I just found that I just found that to be, I did it that way, and so far nobody's complained. Nobody has called me up and said,
you know, I had a signing once in Washington D.C. and I asked my friend Maria from New Jersey. I said, you know, what should I dedicate in Spanish? This is in 2001, and she said, con un afectuoso saludo de Victor Triay, with an affectionate saludo. I don't know how you would translate saludo from. So every
regards,
time I sign one in Spanish, yeah, regards, right? And I'll tell you, people really like it, and you know. So I thank Maria whenever I get a chance. I saw her in the summer.
Go ahead and finish because I'll go ahead and finish.
I saw her at one of my book signings in the summer, and I thanked her. I go, you know, for the past 12 years I've been, you know, doing that dedication you told me, and so she got a big kick out of that. But I still got to get one in English, though. I mean, so I just haven't figured it out yet.
Well, you can always say sincerely, very sincerely, or affectionately yours. I guess that would be somewhat. But I will tell you, if you dedicate the book to my dad and you write that, he's going to look at it to make sure that the accent is in the right place.
Right. Of course.
All right.
Yeah,
so
I would definitely do my homework on accents before I did that.
Yeah, you might want to, you know, check the accent, you know, especially if you get some men of that generation, because they're going to look at you and say, wonderful, wonderful, but, you know, el acento, right? They're going to...
Un pequeño error.
Un pequeño error, right? That's what they're going to say.
Right.
Well, I tell you, before we get into this very interesting topic, on this day in history, March 10th, 1952, a date that I think was very consequential in the 20th century for Cuba, tell us about your books. I know you're in the second episode now, or the second book of a series of books. Why don't you take a few minutes and talk about your books, please?
Well, what I'm currently releasing is actually my first long fiction. It's a series. It's a fictional series. The name of the series is The Unbroken Circle. Specifically, if you want to look it up, especially on Amazon, each book has its own name also. Book one is The Struggle Begins, and book two is called Freedom Betrayed. And book three should be coming out in the summer, maybe the fall. And basically it traces many of the events from the earliest days of the of Castro's rise to power all the way through the early opposition. And it follows a family, you know, and I tried to make the family as appealing as possible and to show as many sides of Cuba, I think, as possible that would be reasonable without forcing it. And, you know, what this family goes through, and all the different stages that so many families went through. I've interviewed, I mean, hundreds of people for my nonfiction books, and you do see a pattern emerge. And these characters kind of follow that. I mean, they were in favor of the revolution early on because they were getting rid of a dictatorship and they're restoring democracy, and then, you know, they find out that this revolution wasn't what it said it was. And, of course, you know, three of the members enter the opposition on the island, And book one traces the family through that period until they got what they called in Cuba burned, quemado. And then at the end of 1960, three of the characters leave Cuba. And I interviewed a lot of people over the course of time that's exactly what happened to them, and that's how they left Cuba. And then, of course, many of the people, not all of them or even most of them, but a lot of people who joined Brigade 2506, which will invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, had been, you know, active in the underground or some kind of an opposition organization before. And when they came into exile, of course, you know, joined the brigade. And so that's what these characters do. But it's not about the events. And it was very important for me to do that. Again, I was trained as a historian, so the first couple of drafts, I said, I sound too much like a history professor, and I can't do that. And it took me many years to write, mostly trying to find that style. You know, the overall theme of it is a universal theme. It's a theme of separation, which is what I think, just in interviewing people and paying attention and listening, that seems to be the overall theme of Cuban families, you know, since 1960, roughly, is separation. And the theme of separation, I think, goes even beyond just the Cuban characters. There's even some other characters that endure separation too. Hence the title of the series, The Unbroken Circle, which is derived from the old Protestant hymn, Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And I think in book two, the reason for the title becomes very clear through an American character. And then the third book traces the lives of the two children of the family who have to come to the United States by themselves, and their experience. And like, you know, I told you, the Bronx is involved in that. So, you
right.
know, most of the location radically changes in book three.
Well, we definitely recommend the books, because I do think that one thing you did very well in your book, Victor, is represent the Cuban family. And I think in that sense you did a very good job. Obviously the history is there, but how these people interacted and lived that history day to day, I think you did a fantastic job. Well, let's get into a little bit of Cuban history. This is before both of us, but nevertheless an important date, March the 10th, 1952, not just on a personal level. My parents had been married the year before. Cuba at the time was going through, I wouldn't say excessively difficult times, because when you compare it to other Latin American countries, it was actually quite peaceful. But nevertheless, I think what happens in 1952 is there emerges, I think maybe this is the last chapter or the next to last chapter of Batista. And just to set the table a little bit for the listeners before we get into it, Cuba had a very dynamic history, 1902 to 1959. I mean, incredibly dynamic history. But a gentleman by the name of Fulgencio Batista comes into the picture in 1933. He leads a rebellion. They call it the Sergeant's Rebellion, I guess. And he becomes the central person in Cuba in the 1930s. And in 1940, Cuba has an election. Batista is elected as the first president. That's right, a new constitution, and Batista is elected in 1940. 1944, there's another election. 1948, there's another election. Now, you have different presidents because I guess they had a re-election clause or something in the constitution.
Right.
Batista is out of the country during much of this time. He comes back in 1948, runs as a senator. He becomes a senator. And in 1952, he wants to run for president again. And the polls are showing that he is behind the two other candidates who are running. In 1952, the presidency of Carlos Prío Socarrás is coming to an end. There's a lot of allegations of corruption. There's a lot of allegations of incompetence. Just the year before, I believe a senator by the name of Eduardo Chivas had shot himself on live TV. I think he died a few weeks
later. On the
radio,
yeah.
On the radio,
right.
You're right, on the radio, yeah. So anyway, there was a little bit, Cuba had a very passionate political system, and I think in 1952, March 10th, 1952, Batista overthrows, he puts together, I guess, a military, overthrows Prio Socarrás, who leaves the country. He now becomes, I'm not sure exactly what he calls himself, but then in 1956, he does hold elections, and he does win, but that's a very controversial election. Just, you know,
right.
I've thrown a lot of history at you there, and I don't know if you want to add anything to it or maybe give it more
historical
context.
I think I think something that distinguishes Batista is that he was so many things throughout his life. I mean, he came from a very humble background. Most people don't know, but he was, you know, Cuba's first non-white president. Even though you do hear a lot about, people who have a pro-Castro tendency, you know, talking about racism in Cuba and how Batista defended the rich in the 1950s, kind of, you know, bringing them all together. But he was a person of a, you know, very poor background. He was mixed with Spanish, African, Indian, and even some Chinese. He entered the army. He was an army stenographer. He was a sergeant, but he was very politically able. He had to have been a very intelligent person and very daring person to lead that sergeant's coup in the 1930s, literally emerging from almost complete obscurity, and then throughout the 1930s somehow be the puppet master behind Cuban politics at a time when he was very young. So I think he understood power and he understood how to use it. But I think he also understood that the dominant force in the hemisphere was the United States. And if you look at his administration in the early 1940s, it was extremely left-leaning, right? And he had all the support of every left-leaning organization in Cuba, from the communists to labor and all of that. Of course, after World War II, the order of the day was anti-communism. And, of course, you know, and he became a firm anti-communist, although people didn't really forget some of his communist leanings. You even hear some of the old folks, refer to, you know, I've heard a conspiracy theory once. This isn't a common one, but that he was probably a communist secretly the whole time, and that's why he opened the door to Fidel Castro, right? Of course, that's more than a stretch, but nevertheless. Mm-hmm. You know, when he took power in 1952, I think there was a lot of, you know, there was a big belief in democracy and in the Constitution, but I think there was also a great deal of frustration mm-hmm. because of the corruption, because of the disorder, because of the,
right.
you know, political chaos. You know, the role, the disproportionate role of certain groups at the university. People who were involved in politics literally, in some cases, got away with murder. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of graft and theft and you know, rumors of ministers and all this other stuff. I mean, it just seemed like a free-for-all politically. So I think, you know, he came in, you know, almost with the same attitude as a Napoleon. I'm coming in to restore order. I'm coming in to save people's freedoms. I'm coming in so that people could live at peace and in peace and, you know, go to school and go to work and the roads will be fixed and there'll be police protection and, you know, et cetera, and have honest administration. And I'm going to clean things up and then I'm going to hold an election.
Right.
And I think that's what he came in with. And the election was in 1954. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was all sorts of, you know, suspicion that there was a good amount of dishonesty in the election, which is how he managed to get himself elected. That's completely plausible that that happened. I think it was after that that, you know, I think there was a lot of people giving him a chance, you
right.
know, to see if he was really going to do what he did. I mean, there was opposition to his coup from the very beginning, but I think a lot of it came after 1954, when people saw that the political corruption on his own part, you know, and himself taking advantage of the very thing that he criticized and said he was going to get rid of,
mm-hmm.
and of course, not to mention, you know, his army and other, you know, paramilitaries attached to him, and so there was a lot of frustration, but, you know, and the pro-democracy groups that emerged, I think, got some popularity. And then there was a large number of groups that opposed him, among them Castro's 26th of July movement. But
right.
I think what people need to understand is that all those groups working together with one another represented Cuba's Democrats, Cuba's
mm-hmm.
pro-democracy politicians. If you looked at all the faces, right, you would have seen José Miro Cardona, you would have seen Tony Verona, you would have seen Carlos Prio, and they all had their groups conspiring against Batista, the student union,
right.
and yes, Castro's 26th of July. The difference with Castro's 26th of July is that they were very effective at marketing themselves abroad, and especially in the United States. They're the ones that got Herbert Matthews to go into the Sierra Maestra and depict them to the world like this, you know, Robin Hood group in the, you know, in Sherwood Forest or something.
Right.
And knowing that whatever was popular in the United States was going to get beamed back to Cuba, and certainly it did. I think that the American media did more to popularize Castro in Cuba than the Cuban media did.
That's right.
But still, you know, I think that even when he fled the country, you know, Castro was just, you know, one of a group of rebels, and mm-hmm. you know, that opposed him. There were a whole bunch of others, and of course, that week-long victory procession to Havana, I think made such a difference in the image of Castro because the groundwork had been laid already by the media and the media images of him. But, you know, again, you know, how do you judge Batista? I mean, you know, people, believe it or not, especially people, you know, of the older generation can still get very passionate. There are a lot of people who point, you know, to the fact that he did bring stability, that the economy flourished under him. You know, Cuba reached, you know, heights of standard of living never before seen. Of course, the 1950s were very good times everywhere. So that's like Mussolini taking credit for
right.
prosperity in Italy in the late 1920s. Well, everybody was doing well in the late
1920s. That's right.
And of course, it meant his... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, when you look at Batista and well, just a couple of quick notes about, you mentioned understanding the powerhouse was the United States. In 1952, and I read this today, in 1952, the coup was on the 10th of March. The American support of the new government was on the 27th of March. And I
right.
thought, the, you know, that obviously was very important for Batista to have the cover or the authorization of the United States.
Oh,
but,
of course.
But the United
Absolutely.
States gives you, they take away, because in 1958, obviously, when
That's
the
right.
United States cut the military assistance, that was pretty much the end of Batista. But
absolutely.
But I think Fulgencio Batista, you know, the figure of Fulgencio Batista, I think his legacy would have been totally different, it seems to me. And I'm speculating, I know, but that's what we like to do, I guess. But
uh-huh.
his legacy would have been totally different, Victor, if in 1952 he doesn't hold that coup, he allows
right.
democracy. Maybe he would have gone down in history as the man of the 1940 Constitution, and
yeah.
Maybe he would have been reelected at another time. These small
Absolutely.
Little moments. So I just kind of throw that in, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, and it was always a dangerous game to do that, because you know, and I guess the point I was trying to make is that there was never a communist revolution in Cuba. It was a pro-democracy revolution to get rid of Batista. Now, you know, again, you talk to some people, they think that, you know, he was judged harshly. Other people, and I'm talking people, you know, all Cuban exiles with, you know, with impeccable anti-Castro credentials, other people will tell you that he's the one who opened the door for Fidel Castro. Right, that you know, Cuba's democracy was sputtering and it was imperfect, right? But his coup is what set the country in a revolutionary mode, which is really all the communists need, is for a country to be in a revolutionary mode. Because
right.
as long as there's a revolution and as long as there's chaos, there is something they can hijack, right? And that's exactly what they did in Russia. I mean, in Russia, you know, the revolution that got rid of the Tsar wasn't a communist revolution. It was a whole different revolution. The communists hijacked that revolution several months later. But again, once you open the door to that sort of disorder, you know, especially in the 1950s, there was always the possibility for communism, and that's exactly what happened in Cuba. So, you know, many people point to his coup as really the beginning of Fidel Castro's career.
Well, I've had that, you know,
Castro could take advantage of.
Yeah, go, you're right. I mean, I've heard
that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Victor, that I've heard that line of reasoning from so many people of my parents' generation, that was
right.
the beginning where, number one, a lot of the young people, many in the universities, became very disillusioned with the institutions
right.
at that point and say, you know, we got to fix this thing. And then,
right.
of course, you have to maybe the more radical approach. But I just think that, you know, looking back at this date, the 10th of Marzo, I think that, you know, it is a consequential date, and whether it created Castro or whether that was just a coincidence, I guess, you know, we will never know 100%. But I do think that if Cuba would have turned out different in the 1950s, I mean, Castro himself was running, I believe, for the House of Representatives in 1952. So he would have been maybe elected or law, but he definitely would have been a different figure after 52.
Right.
You know, who
sure.
knows? Again, we're speculating, but... But I just feel,
right.
I mean, I think the biggest thing for me when I look back at this date is how this date, I think, may have forever destroyed the legacy of Batista, where Batista's ambition may have gotten the best of him. So anyway, that's just kind of a way of looking
sure.
back at Marzo 10, 1952. But I know my parents will tell you that they thought that, in fact, I've had a lot of Cubans say to me of their generation that they thought even Carlos Prio Socarrás should have been tougher and should have defended the
right.
presidency even more. So, you know, I guess you get all kinds
yeah,
of opinions,
no.
don't you?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I think once you saw the military move, and in those situations, you know, he who has the guns wins, I guess, is the assumption. And, you know, and a lot did have to do with the United States, because you knew that the United States was at least going to play a major role in deciding, you know, to legitimize this or not legitimize this. And ironically, you know, and there's a lot of ironies here because, you know, Batista was involved with the Constitution of 1940, and he was the first president elected under the Constitution of 1940, and yet the revolution to overthrow him, ironically, was about restoring the Constitution of 1940.
Yeah, we're still waiting for that one. Yeah, we're still waiting for that restoration, And also,
right,
if I may just say one last thing.
You know,
No, I was just going to say one last thing before we run out of time, but I was going to say one thing that one of the amazing, you were talking before about something that I didn't know, but it kind of comes full circle now in my mind after you said it. You were saying that his first administration had some left-leaning tendencies, and if you read the 1940 Constitution, it is actually a lot more like the Mexican Constitution or some of the other constitutions that have a lot of guarantees, you know, labor guarantees, minimum wage guarantees, a lot of that stuff that you don't see in the American Constitution, but you see more in a more of a socialist undertone, I guess. So I was just curious when you said that he had that left-leaning, it just made me say that.
Right. No, definitely. I mean, even his first administration, you know, was supported by, you know, some of Cuba's leading communists. But again, remember, in 1940, okay, and throughout the 1930s, the communists weren't the bad guys. It was the Depression, and, you know, at least in most people's minds, the bad guys were the Nazis and the fascists, you know, and the communists were, you know, as of at least 1941, our allies against the common enemy. And then, of course, you know, it turns out the communists were, you know, after the fascists were defeated, became our primary enemy. So, I mean, it wouldn't be that strange for, you know, anyone, you know, during the Great Depression to seek communist support. It was in fashion, unfortunately, but it was.
In the 1930s to understand that, too. I mean, it was a very difficult decade. I mean, even here in the United States, I mean, there was some concern about, was it Huey Long, who was the senator from
Louisiana,
who was a very populist kind of candidate, you know, a chicken in every pot.
Sure.
And there was concerns that he might win the presidency because of all the economic
problems. I mean, there was that fear. You had, you know, Father Coughlin, you had, you know, Dr. Townsend, and it was calm in this country because, you know, without the Great Depression, there is no World War II. I mean, the Great Depression caused World War II. What, you know, that's why people voted for the Nazis. That's what got Hitler into power, was a depression, not the Versailles Treaty or anything else. It was a depression. It's why Japan invaded China. You know, all these forces, I think, were unleashed by the Great Depression. And so, yeah, I mean, things were very unsettled during that time, including in the comparatively stable United States.
Right, and of course the other thing too that my father tells me is that, you know, he was just a little boy in the 1930s, but Cuba was hit very hard by the Depression because of the drop in the price of sugar, and so it was a very tough time in Cuba in the 1930s, and later on, I don't know what president, whether it was Batista or a different president, who made the arrangements with the United States to guarantee the price of sugar. I don't know which one made that arrangement.
Sure. Yeah.
But that arrangement meant for Cuba, economically speaking, that was a very important. Well, Victor, we're going to have to wrap it up. But I tell you, this is a very interesting look back at Cuba and all these factors. As I said at the introduction, you know, I'm not an expert on the 10th of March, but I do think it's a consequential date. And I think it had an impact in Cuba. And certainly, who knows? Who knows what the history of Cuba would have been like if it had turned out differently, if Batista had simply said, no, let's respect the election, let me just go along with the vote. Who knows? Who knows how the history of Cuba...
I think if Batista had taken that attitude, there's a pretty good chance you wouldn't be doing a radio show out of Dallas, Texas. You might be doing
Havana. Right, or you wouldn't have written your books.
I think everything
Maybe you would have written a book about the great Cuban Democrat Fulgencio Batista. You know, it's
right,
interesting
how he saved Cuban democracy.
how he saved Cuban democracy and was the author of the 1940, not the author, but the man who made the 1940 Constitution possible. It's just amazing how history can be that way. You as a historian probably know that as well as anybody. One more time, tell us about the books.
Okay, well, again, the title of the series is The Unbroken Circle, and there's book one, book two, book three. Book one, which is out and available on Amazon, is called The Struggle Begins, and or The Series Begins, right, because the series is about a struggle, so The Struggle Begins. And book two is called Freedom Betrayed, which takes the reader with his family through the whole Bay of Pigs episode and the immediate aftermath of it. And then book three, which should be out in summer or fall, picks up the story in roughly the summer of 1961.
And we should also, I just want to tell the audience that we have a link to your Amazon page on the show information, but
Great.
You also wrote a book about Pedro Pan. And
right.
I think you may have been the first person to write a book about Pedro Pan.
That's right. That's right. I was. That was published by the University Press of Florida in 1998. The title is Fleeing Castro, Operation Pedro Pan and the Cuban Children's Program. I got very lucky because, you know, that was a time where already several years had passed. I mean, most people who were Pedro Pan's, and we've talked about this, they didn't know they were part of a big
That's
program.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, when Monsignor Walsh and a few other people got an organization going, more and more people became aware. And so, therefore, there were more articles, more television shows. But still, most people who were Pedro Pan's weren't even aware of it, even at that point. And that's kind of when I stepped in, when it just started to, you know, to rise a little bit in public interest. So I wrote it at exactly the right time, I think. Like I said, nowadays, you know, all these years later, of course, the Pedro Pan organization is much larger and thriving, just, you know, simply because I think more people became aware that they were part of this semi-secret program.
When you have 14,000 kids, I mean, eventually the story is going to come out, you know, 14,000.
Right, right.
Is it true, Victor, that it is the largest exodus of unaccompanied children? Is that correct, that it is the largest one?
At least in the Western Hemisphere, as far as I know, yes. I don't know about in Europe, because, of course, you had a lot of very devastating wars in Europe, and I know that you had the kinder transport of Jewish children out of continental Europe into Britain, which I'm not sure of the numbers, but I know that was pretty big. And a person who worked on that program was one of the key people in Pedro Pan in Cuba later, which was Penny Powers, and who was British, and she actually stayed living in Cuba after all of that.
Now, the other exodus, too, is the Spanish children during the Spanish Civil War. Many of those children went to Mexico, actually, and they have a very glorious story, too, in Mexico. There are books, by the way, written about them, somewhat similar to Pedro Pan also, similar stories.
Right.
In fact, some of the largest companies had
a large number from the Basque country that were taken to Russia.
Exactly,
as well.
and some of the largest companies in Mexico, some of the large Mexican groups, were actually started by some of these families. Well, Victor, thank you so much for joining us tonight on short notice.
All right, Sylvia.
Very interesting chat about Diez de Marzo, and thank you so much for giving me your input. It's always very appreciated, and the book about Pedro Pan, that's the book I have to read next. I haven't gotten to that one yet, so that's my next one on the list.
All right, well, great. I hope you enjoy it, and thank you again for having me on your show.
Okay, thank you so much. Victor Trey, author Victor Trey, and as I say, we have a link to his page on the show information. Make sure you click on that and check out some of his amazing books about Cuba. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and this was a topic that we did tonight with our good friend Victor Trey. And by the way, let me remind you again about his link, the show link information, where you can check out his book. But this is a topic, 10th of March, that I've been thinking about for quite some time, and just by coincidence, it fell today, and we were able to do a show. But this is one of those dates, you know, having grown up in a Cuban family and having grown up in the United States as I did and hearing all these great Cuban stories of the 1950s, my parents were, I wouldn't say politically active in the sense that they were in the streets, but they were very much politically aware. I think people of their generation were very politically aware. And I've heard many, many stories about this date, March 10th, 1952. My parents had just recently gotten married, so they were settling down. I think at the time, I think at the time they were living in Sahua La Grande, which is where my father was working at the bank. So they were kind of settling down, getting their family started, getting their, you know, their life started. And they obviously went through this. They remember it quite well. They can tell you stories about what happened that day. And I think that the most interesting character, I believe, in this 10th of March story is Batista himself, as we were talking with Victor. Batista was actually an incredible human being. He had been in Cuban history in so many different chapters and had played so many different roles. 1933 as the sergeant who overthrew the Machado government, then putting together the 1940 Constitution, serving as the first president under that Constitution. And one wonders what his legacy would have been like if he had not done this. I think his ambition got the best of him, I think, with this military coup. And then, of course, he became a target for many groups in Cuba. He became sort of the anti-democratic, the anti-constitutional figure. But one wonders what his legacy in Cuban history would have been like had this March 10th had not happened, had there not been a military coup that day engineered by Batista. Speaking of elections and speaking of countries, our next program we're going to be talking about El Salvador, where you may be following the elections down there. You may know that it's pretty much of a dead heat right now. I think 99.9% of the votes have been cast, maybe not 99.9, but pretty close to 99% have been cast, and the difference is like 6,700 votes between basically two candidates, one from the left, one from the right. One of the interesting things about this election, this is the first time that citizens of El Salvador in the United States are going to be able to participate in the election. So we'll see what happens. We'll see how many. There's already accusations of fraud you would expect in a very close election like this. We're going to be talking, by the way, with Miguel Portillo Cuadra, who is a new friend of our show in Los Angeles. You know, Los Angeles is the largest center in the country for people from El Salvador, and he grew up in the United States, but obviously has very close ties to what's happening in El Salvador. So we'll be talking about the election and what happens next. Unfortunately, I think it's going to be very difficult to govern El Salvador after an election like this, because it's not just a close election. It's really a rift between the left and the right. It's a first-rate rift, and sometimes those kinds of close elections like that are very difficult to bring people back together after the election. So hopefully, what I'm hoping is, after they decide who won the election, I'm hoping that the loser will go to the microphone and say, okay, I accept defeat, let's move on. I hope they do that, because if they continue to ask for recounts or whatever, this mess will never get settled, and the country is just going to continue drifting into more and more chaos, as we've seen, unfortunately, with much of Central America here in the last 10 or 15 years. Well, that's going to do it for tonight. My thanks again to Victor Trey for joining us, and I hope that you enjoyed it, our little look back at the 10th of March, 1952, one of those dates in Cuban history that had an impact, to say the least. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.